I was thinking about perhaps the one thing that we should look at just briefly before we leave Elijah and Elisha is 2 Kings 2, which is where the succession happens. And we have the curious departure of Elijah. I remember the scene being one of the color plates in our family Bible when I was growing up, and I always thought it looked very scary the way this particular image was drawn with the flaming chariot flying up, and it was painted so it was very, very dark, and the chariot was this really bright orange. But when the Lord, even the chapter begins in a curious manner. When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind. Elijah is one of the few people in the Old Testament, one of three, that we are not told he actually died. The first one is, which one is it now? Why is his name escaping me? I'm sorry. Excuse me? He walked with God, and that's it. He lived so long and he walked with God. We're not given his, and the rest of that whole litany of all of those ancient forefathers, we're given how long he lived and when he died. And he died at such and such ancient, doesn't it? And he walked with God. Same with Moses. There's a double tradition with Moses, whether he died and there's a place of his burial, but it just says, and the place of his tomb is never known. And the tradition, the interpretive tradition is that it wasn't known because if it had been known, it would have become a shrine, a place of worship, and that would have been a bad thing. But there's a parallel tradition because Moses goes off and he just never comes back, that he was assumed into heaven, that God just took him up. Because also it says that Moses walked with God. Though God called him and he left. He just was gone. And then there's Elijah. And Elijah, though, is the one who is the one of them that we actually have a dramatic story about. Elisha has been following him as more or less his apprentice, and Elijah again is one, I said he fulfills like almost all of the categories we talked about. He leads a group of prophets. We see them referred to a number of times here. One of the guild prophets will come talk and do something. And right after Elisha gets the mantle, the guild prophets in Jericho see him and follow him. So there's a prophetic guild mentioned specifically in terms of Elijah and Elisha. They hear Elijah said to Elisha, "The Lord has sent me on to Bethel. As the Lord lives and you live yourself," Elisha replied, "I will not leave you." So they go down to Bethel. The guild prophets went out to Elisha and asked him, "Do you know that the Lord will take your master over today?" "Yes, I know it," he replied. Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, Elisha, for the Lord has sent me on to Jericho." And Elisha insists on following him to Jericho. "Stay here, the Lord has sent him three times, okay? Please stay here, the Lord has sent me on to Jordan. As the Lord lives and you live yourself, I will not leave you," and so the two went on together. 50 of the guild prophets followed. So he's got this whole school following him. And Elijah took up his mantle, rolled it up, and struck the water, which divided, and both crossed over on dry ground, so they crossed the Jordan. Elisha succeeds. When they had crossed over, Elijah said to Elisha, "Ask whatever I may do for you before I am taken." Elisha answers, "May I receive a double portion of your spirit?" "You've asked something's not easy," he replied. "Still, if you see me taken up from you, your wish will be granted, otherwise not." And as they walked on, conversing, a flaming chariot and flaming horses came between them, and Elijah went up to heaven in the whirlwind. And that's the departure of Elijah and the commissioning of Elisha. Elijah's mantle had fallen from him, and Elisha goes back and takes it from the bank of the Jordan. Again, he strikes the water and crosses back over to Jericho, where the guild of prophets are waiting, and they acknowledge him as having received Elijah's spirit. And he becomes the next leader of this guild of prophets. If we had looked to, and I can't remember exactly where it is now, at one point we are given a description of Elijah's general raiment, And it is very similar to the raiment that we will see on John the Baptist, wearing the camel's hair and a leather belt, just very coarse and very contrary to the gold and gems and so on that the king is wearing. Here he comes, you know, in his animal skins to confront the king so often. You can just imagine these kind of ascetic prophets, guild of prophets wandering around, what kind of an image they would present to the people, and how curious people would be as to these people wandering around and wearing this unusual form of clothing. So, anyhow, so we had gotten, other than that little aside again, we had pretty much gotten to the time of the Assyrian conquest. Is there any discussion or any other questions? I've been doing a lot of the talking today that you wanted to mention about the kingdom of Israel or that side before we move on to Judah and...
Besides kings,
no, we don't have like a book of Elijah and Elisha.
No, but I don't refer to, or if there were stories about them, other than the references that you
have. Not that I'm familiar with. I mean, there's certainly, I'm sure there's rabbinic narrative, but it's not anything I've read yet at this point. But
I mean, it's not in some of the other books.
And again, with some of these, like Amos, we will be talking about specifically next week. So I'm not going to go into his particular story or his message specifically at this point. Really, what we wanted to do with this session is get through the background material and get the setting all laid out and the general pattern of it. So we move then to the next stage, the next phase in this, which again is a relatively small one, relatively. And this is the time between the two conquests. We have the prophets here are Micah. And again, I don't know how this came across on your pages.
The darker ones are the prophets, but you can see it very clearly.
The prophets are Micah, and then Zephaniah, Nahum, Habakkuk, and Jeremiah. The ones in between, Ahaz through Josiah, are the kings of Judah during that time. We have a little bit more stability here than we saw in the last few generations. But it's a little misleading, too, because the timeline's not broken out quite the same way.
I'm confused.
Okay, that's okay, Woody.
I'm looking at this comparative timeline now. Are you talking about the time between the two conquests, and what period of time is that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, between the conquests, that's 721 to 640. From the time of the Assyrian conquest through the reign of Josiah.
The Assyrian conquest happens around 640.
Now, the Assyrian conquest was 721. There's the Assyrian conquest of the northern kingdom. Israel is now, by the time we get to this next chart, Israel is gone. We're just looking at Judah, the southern kingdom. On the very bottom there, I have Sargon and Sennacherib, and there's quite a bit of confusion over which one it is that conquered Israel, because the tradition is Sennacherib, but many of the historians will say at that period of time, Sargon was the king. Now, but Sennacherib may have been the one who went out. He was the successor to Sargon. I have the map here showing the extent of the Babylonian and Assyrian empires. There's also a really good website, I think I have it linked on my webpage, called Maps of War. It's just mapsofwar.com, and they've got a whole bunch of other stuff on it. But one of the things they have is I don't know if I want to say an interactive map, but a moving map that, animated, I guess, map animation of the various kingdoms or empires that conquered the Middle East from very, very early times, but 2000 BC, all the way through contemporary times. And it's very interesting to watch that segment. So if you get a chance, if you can link to it and look at that. I think I've got it linked on the web page. It's Maps of War. And that's a very interesting one to watch and see the movement of that. And then another one that's on that same site that is good is the Spread of Religion. It shows the spread of different religions in the world beginning with very primitive times and going through China. You know, it shows the whole world, so it kind of shows it spreading back and forth. And that's another one that's interesting to get that visual of the spread of different faiths and where they went. And as it gets into more and more contemporary times, it's really interesting to watch the play of things between Christianity and Islam going back and forth, particularly in the Middle East and Europe, and that, the succession of who's in control of what.
So these new non-prophets that you said were kings, the kings of Assyria?
No, those five are kings of Judah. Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, Amon, Josiah. And then the two kings of Judah, the two kings of Assyria are at the very bottom there, Sargon and Sennacherib. The five right after Micah, Ahaz through Josiah, those are the kings. And you can see there is not a whole lot of prophecy in terms of what's written in what shows up in Kings or even the other accounts during this time in Judah. We have Micah at the beginning of this period, over during the time of while Israel is being conquered, giving warning, both warning and comfort, to the southern kingdom. And then not much until we get to the time of Josiah and we start seeing some more activity. And this is at the same time that the Babylonian Empire off in the east and the north off over in Mesopotamia is beginning to supplant the Assyrian Empire. But it's not yet disturbing Judah. It hasn't come that far. So we have Ahaz, who's essentially a bad king. Hezekiah is a good king. Manasseh and Amon are not so good. Actually, Manasseh is considered quite troublesome. And then Josiah. And Josiah is a good king. Hezekiah and Josiah are our two reformers. And if you remember when we talked about Deuteronomy, it was Josiah who was reforming the temple and found the book of the law and took it to the prophetess Huldah, who told him, yes, this is the will of God. We should have been doing these things. This is God's law, and you have violated it. And because of the violations, there will be disaster will come upon the people, but not during your reign, because you, Josiah, are a good king. And I've always found it fascinating that he took it to Huldah. When you look at Josiah and look at, he had Zephaniah, Nahum, Habakkuk, and Jeremiah all at the same time. He could have taken to any one of these prophets. There seems to have been a school, another one of these prophetic guilds, operating during the time of Josiah. And he doesn't go to any of them. He goes to Huldah. Yeah, 640 is... Well, it's just the time of Josiah, and then we'll move from the next frame is from Josiah until the return. So just from Josiah through the time of exile and then the return. The exile doesn't happen. The conquest by Assyria doesn't happen until 587, or by Babylon, excuse me. So this is just kind of a little interlude here. These three or four kings, I guess five really, but Amon hardly counts because he only reigns for a year. So we have this time of, it's not exactly a time of quiet. And again, this is somewhat misrepresentative as far as the size of the graph, because this is only about 80 years. It's not a huge period of time. But we have two, within that 80 years, we have two attempts at reform, two more or less good kings, Hezekiah and Josiah, who try to bring the people back. They are not entirely successful in their attempts, and the reign of Manasseh in between is a problem for and Manasseh is just chapter 21 in 2 Kings. It's not a very long section at all. No, I missed, I know what I missed putting on here. I missed putting Isaiah in here somehow. I must have been falling asleep on things or something. Because we should have first Isaiah also overlapping. We have him, I think I didn't do it because I had him in the beginning of, at the end of the previous one, around 740, but he should carry right over into the time of Hezekiah. If you were to look in 19 and 20, we have Isaiah specifically mentioned interacting with Hezekiah. Second Kings 19 and 20 is Hezekiah and Isaiah. And this is Sennacherib attempts to take the city of Jerusalem during the time of Hezekiah here, but does not succeed because of the prayers that are offered, because Hezekiah and Isaiah are faithful. And we read this very small section at the end of chapter 19 after the whole concern and the prayer over this. That night the angel of the Lord went forth and struck down 185,000 men in the Assyrian camp. And early the next morning, there they were, all the corpses of the dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, broke camp and went back home to Nineveh. That's... And then his sons kill him and take over from him. Just kind of a little footnote there. We have another thing that's interesting throughout the narratives of the kings is the not infrequent mention of books that we don't have. These scrolls of the kings, the scrolls of King Solomon, the Acts of Solomon, the scrolls of the kings, the Acts of the kings of Judah, the scrolls of the Acts of the kings of Israel, and a couple of other just mentions. And we had seen that earlier too with reference to the Book of the Wars of Yahweh and things like that in the older narrative, where we've got these books of battles and conquests and annals of the kings that we don't have. Now, there's two-sided speculation. Were there really such texts and they've just gone missing? Or is this a literary device to say, well, there is more, but I'm not going to tell you all that it's somewhere else. And we don't have it, so we can't say one way or the other. My inclination would be to think there probably were written records being kept and that these were used. Now, how thorough they were, how accurate they were, that may be questionable. But I can't see any reason to say that they wouldn't have been keeping records. And all of the other kingdoms, we've got tablets and so on with records of the deeds of the kings. They've made monuments to themselves. Those for Israel and Judah, we don't have as much evidence, largely probably because that kingdom was so often overtaken by other kingdoms that anything that did exist didn't exist for very long because somebody came in and sacked them, and they were just happened to be on the way in between two kingdoms. Very seldom did it seem that any of these conquests happened because Assyria or Babylon or Egypt or whoever was coming through really saw great value in the land of Judah. It was rather they were the land bridge between Mesopotamia and Egypt. You want these two very fertile valleys, the Mesopotamian region, the Nile region. These are desirable lands. Well, if you live in one and you want to conquer the other, how do you get there? You go along the Mediterranean, you're not going to cross the desert. You go along the Mediterranean. Whose lands do you trample on? Israel. They just happen to be in the way. So certainly from their perspective, these nations are against us. Well, yes, they do come against you, are you the ones that are actually after? Only because you're in the way. You happen to be a stepping stone to bigger and better things. And you can kind of see that if you look at the maps of Egypt. Here's the Babylonian Empire. Here's Egypt, which they want to get. And there's poor little Israel, right, and Judah, right here in the way.